The most obnoxious of these kids was named Eggy. His real name was Eddie. Because his father never missed a game and always interfered with play, Eddie was on the field much more than his skills would have deserved. My thuggish friends and I resented this, of course. In revenge, we tagged Eddie Eggy. Yes, it was stupid, but then so were we. Since I was the leader of the pack, Eddie's father threatened me with bodily harm if I didn't lay off, a big mistake. That made the problem even worse. Eddie became Ham and Eggy or Scrambled Eggy. By the time we reached Eggy Benedict, the kid was crazy. One steamy August night, my gang was playing stickball in the street near Eddie's split-level house. When he came out to join us, he hit a barrage of Eggy jokes. He ran back inside. Moments later, his father, red-faced and making guttural noises, raced out of the house and made a run right at me. I quickly gathered that he was not interested in a calm conversation about issues, so I bolted. I was quick, but for an old geezer, probably about 40 as I look back, this guy could really haul. Desperately, I considered my options. They were all bad. I could see that I couldn't run fast enough to lose the guy. If I ran inside my house for safety, my father would become involved, and that was suicide. If I kept on running around the block, there was a good chance that Eddie's father might actually catch me. Sweating and panting, I finally thought, screw it, I'll run into the house. Eddie's father came in right behind me without stopping to knock. I ran upstairs into my room. Eddie's father stopped in the living room, startling the hell out of my father, who was drinking a cold one and reading the paper. Quaking in my room, I heard loud noises erupt downstairs. The few words I could make out were not complimentary to me. Suddenly, the conversation stopped completely. There was a moment of awful silence. Then I heard the front door close. My mother's voice was saying something about calming down. The words calm down were never good news in my house. Next, I heard my father's footsteps on the stairs. Decades later, I can still hear my father's footsteps on the stairs. Remember those stories at night around the campfire? This was much worse. My father, who had a no-knock policy in our house, barged into the room. I was sitting on the bed, intently staring at my dirty sneakers, when my 6'3" father loomed over me and then shocked me nearly senseless. "Look it," he said in a reasonable voice. What was this? With my full and amazed attention, he went on. "Eggy's father is a nut, so stop calling Eggy Eggy. The kid's got enough problems, and I don't want this guy coming to the house again. Got it?" Yeah, I got it, and I never forgot it. The truth is, I had a behavioral problem that would have turned Cosby's Dr. Huxtable into a foaming-at-the-mouth lunatic. That night, however, my father attacked the problem in a way that got through to me. I didn't reform overnight, but I got to thinking. Eggy did have enough problems. We were picking on him because we thought he was getting something we deserved on the ball field, but we had the whole thing upside down. He was the victim of a very strange father. I didn't want to be a bully, and I guess my father knew that. Eggy became Eddie again. Most of the time, I'm sorry to say, I didn't figure out where my father was coming from. I was just afraid of him. Thank God, long before he died, I began to understand how much he really cared for his family. I also understood that surviving his rigid, sometimes brutal regime gave me discipline and motivation, the values that have been essential to my success. Put another way, after living with my father for 17 years, I was never frightened by anything ever again. He had immunized me against fear. Your parents may have done the same thing, but whatever they did, as I've already stated, we'd be smart to take the good from our parents and turn the bad to our advantage. As we grow older, we watch our parents decline. No longer do they appear to be, as we thought as kids, always in command and all-knowing. They become dependent, demanding, even confused. It's our job, then, to take over as their parents in a way. We have to help them out, and we should do so gladly, no matter what the frustration or the expense. This is a non-negotiable obligation. Finally, you must ensure that your parents live out their lives with dignity. Do so, and good things will happen in your life. Besides, your kids will be watching and taking notes. Viewer time out. Am I sounding preachy? Don't mean to, but some in the audience aren't convinced. O'Reilly, I know you're proud of your pomposity, but couldn't you just say, I think once in a while? You can be just as pompous by saying, I think. Marvin B., West Valley City, Utah. Okay, Marvin, I think what I've said about the parent factor is worth saying. If you want to, get back to me on that. I'm always ready for feedback. This just in, Where does your family start? Well, it starts with a young man falling in love with a girl. No superior alternative has yet been found. Winston Churchill, 1950. Righto, Winston. So that's why we're going to move from the parent factor to the dating factor. The year was 1990. The occasion was a bachelor auction to benefit the American Cancer Society. Your humble correspondent was the object of a bidding war between a pretty Irish nurse and a dark-haired Jewish stockbroker. The bidding, incredibly, was up to more than $3,000 for a date with me. Was this nuts or what? As I stood there, I couldn't believe that two young women were willing to pay this kind of money to go out with a guy who was the world's worst date until his mid-20s. But I had plenty of excuses to explain why it took me so long to get it right. When I was growing up, dating was restricted, or so I thought, to healthy young teenagers from California with names like Annette and Gidget. In other words, to this working-class teenager, dating was a fantasy, something far away and a bit frightening. That attitude toward dating was common in the 1950s and 60s because American society was much more innocent back then. But look at how society has changed now. Dating begins in grammar school and extends to the AARP. At all ages and from all backgrounds, the dating factor works best when you start with low expectations. Don't greet your partner with an unspoken agenda a mile long. Don't expect him or her to fulfill all your fantasies. Hey, when did that last happen in real life? Just try to have a good time. Relax. Maybe if you stay cool, Mr. or Mrs. right now, will show up. According to the calendar, I came of dating age in the mid-1960s, but there was an obstacle thanks to my upbringing. Since I was enrolled in an all-boys Catholic high school, I was clueless for much too long about how to approach the opposite sex. And as I've mentioned, the nuns and the brothers weren't exactly helpful on this issue. I know you can guess that the subject didn't come up by itself in my household. And I was not going to bring it up. Some well-intentioned somebody, not my parents, of course, gave me a copy of Ann Landers' Do's and Don'ts of Teenage Dating. You'll not be surprised to learn that old Ann was dead set against teenage sex. If we ignored her advice and did have sex, we would become outcasts in the community. Our lives would be ruined, but that was only part of it. Possibly we'd wind up in a hospital someplace with a disease that she couldn't even name because it was too gross. But Anne did not have to worry about me. I was as far away from the action as Lawrence Welk, because I had no one to don't with, even if I wanted to do. Of course, there are two sides to every question. Anne Landers had made her point, but on the other side was Hugh Hefner, who seemed to be having one hell of a time with no hospital in sight. Playboy magazine answered the rules and regulations of the Landers training manual with four color photos of what was under those bulky sweaters the neighborhood girls were wearing. It was all over for me, game, set, match, tournament to Mr. Hefner. The question, how could I join Hugh's club? Unfortunately, the answer was clear. I could not. In the first place, as we know, I was Catholic and would be blasted down to hell. And there was another obstacle to joining his club. There were no naked babes slinking around my neighborhood, or as far as I knew, anywhere else on Long Island. But there was an even bigger hurdle. Young O'Reilly had no moves. Count 'em. None. Meantime, other kids in the neighborhood leapt ahead of me. Finally, though, I got lucky. The girl was only a year older in age, but decades ahead of me in experience. The year was 1968. When young women were burning bras in public places and hordes of kids were staging love-ins. Those things seem very far away and hard to imagine. I was operating at a much different level. I asked her to a movie. My thought was, that will reduce the time for awkward conversation. Sure, she said, why don't we go to the drive-in? The drive-in? You mean the outdoor theater where you sit in a dark car for 4 hours watching double features starring Annette and Frankie? That drive-in? Yes. Hugh Hefner's face immediately popped into my mind, grinning that wicked grin. I wondered if I should get a pipe or show up in my pajamas. So we went to the drive-in in my maroon Mercury Comet, and this girl reduced me to rubble. Toward the end of Annette and Frankie's second adventure, I had reached second base and had a good lead toward third. But it's all in the timing, of course, and her parents had a non-negotiable curfew. When I left her at the front door, I gently kissed her goodnight. She said she had had a good time. I couldn't reply very clearly. My tongue had lost all feeling. When I glanced in the living room mirror as I walked in the door at home, I realized I was covered with red welts. Not good. My mother was waiting up, and red welts probably meant interrogation. I mumbled something about poison oak. Mom seemed to buy that excuse and said goodnight. Now that I think about it, she probably wanted me out of the room before she broke out laughing. Did I mention that dating has something to do with parenting? It was that first lucky drive-in experience that turned me into a dating lunatic. Refined, cultured girls didn't really like me very much, but working-class girls seemed to like me just fine. I had a car, a sense of humor, and plenty of chewing gum. If I was a good date, and I think I was, it's because I followed this rule. I didn't go out with anyone I didn't like just to get some action, and I kept my mouth shut afterward. The 70s and early 80s were the best dating years of all time, with the possible exception of ancient Rome. The books tell you that the roaring 20s were pretty wild, but I put my money on the disco years. The energy rocking through those dance clubs was geologic. Talk about low expectations. Everybody was there for one reason, to meet new people. That was enough. My thing was the music. I was a dancing machine. Sock it to me, Donna Summer. Let's shake this place, Gloria Gaynor. Now, this was the lad of a quarter century ago, okay? But I make no apologies. I loved the all-out dancing, and quite a few girls loved to dance with me. The dancing got me dates. The dancing said, hey, let's have some fun and see what happens next. A few hours at clubs like Shenanigans, and most of my dates wanted to extend the evening at their place or mine. By 1975, I was regularly on TV, and that was the greatest dating advantage a man could wish for. During my TV jobs in Dallas, Denver, Boston, and Portland, Oregon, I was shameless. Hi, my name's O'Reilly. Perhaps you've seen me making a fool of myself, on Channel 9, or have you? Can I buy you a drink or take you to Vegas? Yeah, this was pretty shallow, but if you're listening to lyrics like we're doing it 4 nights a week, you might be pretty shallow too. Since I've dated hundreds of women in my life, I think I've learned a thing or two about the opposite sex. How could I not? The biggest thing I've learned, as I mentioned earlier, is that men and women have different agendas in the romance department. This bears repeating. Women usually want to find the one Mr. Right of their dreams, and men want to find all the dream girls they can get their hands on. If you are young and single today, the disco years must sound as far back as the Dark Ages. AIDS and other STDs have changed dating forever. Fear is now part of the equation. Having multiple partners became dangerous, and going out with a stranger after a night of hot dancing can earn you a death sentence, and there's no appeal to the Supreme Court. But I was young and single at a great time to be young and single, I admit it. I miss those carefree dating days. It's a radically different dating world for teenagers in the 21st century. It seems as if most young kids today know everything they need to know about dating by the time they're 14. If they don't, they're sure putting on a good front. Backup stats. According to one study reported in 1997 in the Journal of the American Medical Association, about 17% of 12- and 13-year-old American teenagers admitted having sexual intercourse. Others that age report engaging in oral sex because they believe wrongly there's no chance of contracting an STD. Now there is cybersex or technosex on the internet. Use email and you will be spammed by unsolicited messages from Little Debbie or whomever who has just turned 18 and wants to show you nude pictures of her friends at the birthday party. Can this be good? I don't think so. Dating was exciting to me because it was a slow build-up to something special. I'm talking about the best kind of dating. Now, immediate gratification is the order of the day. The thrill of the chase has been replaced by the predictability of the computer or the convenience of the video cassette. Why risk rejection with a live human being when you can make all of your fantasies come true with the push of a button? And you can always charge it. Bulletin. Because of the way our American society is structured, dating is about the only way to choose a good spouse, and that decision is probably the most important you will ever make. A mistake can become a disaster that can ruin your life and someone else's forever. So get good at dating and hang it up when the right person comes along. Evaluate others the way you would evaluate a car or a house or a new suit. Is this one really right for you? At the same time, don't make snap judgments. Give the person a chance. Sometimes she's nervous or having a bad night. Remember, it's happened to you, too. If you pay attention, you'll learn a lot about a person fast. When I was in college and could barely afford shoes, which isn't that unusual in your college years, I asked out a young woman who knew my financial situation. When we went to some modest restaurant off campus, she ordered lobster, by far the most expensive dish on the menu. That's all I needed to know. This is one hell of a selfish woman with no consideration for me and my wallet. Another woman asked me point blank on our second date what my intentions were. I was just as frank. I intend to take you to a medium-priced restaurant, then go to a dance club, and then try to convince you to give me a back rub. She was not amused. She did not find this admirable sincerity charming. In fact, she brooded for most of the evening. The back rub idea apparently rubbed her the wrong way. Please forgive me. But hey, don't worry about rejection. It happens to everyone. In my business, you meet some of the most physically attractive women on the planet. You'd be amazed by how many of them are insecure because they've been rejected along the way. It can be a lonely planet unless we keep trying to get to know each other better. If you are nice to your dates, things will someday fall your way. But be smart, too. Don't get desperate because then you might make the mistake of letting someone exploit you. You don't want to have to be in a relationship all the time. There's nothing wrong with who you are when you happen to be single. Sometimes it will work out much better if you just take your time, let the pressure ease off, and become close to somebody slowly. But if you do find someone with whom you have that unmistakable chemistry, and by some miracle there's an old drive-in movie nearby, well, take advantage of it. I wish I could say that I took advantage of the bachelor auction that started this discussion, but things did not work out. After spending $3,000 to go out with me, the dark-haired woman understandably got very intense. I took her out to a nice restaurant and tried to keep the conversation light, my usual first date strategy. She was having none of that. Since she was wearing a low-cut blouse that would make the Victoria's Secret catalog blink, it was all I could do to make eye contact, and she enjoyed my dilemma. By the time dessert arrived, she was asking me where our relationship was heading. Now, keep in mind that this lady had plunked down $3,000 for a few hours with your humble correspondent. I kind of felt guilty because I knew the relationship was fast heading south. Finally, I looked her in the eye, perhaps for the third time all evening, and said what all guys say. It's not you, it's me. Remember, this was way before Seinfeld ever got on the air. A final word. Like Ann Landers, I've come up with a little manual for dealing with the opposite sex, but my point of view is not the same. Bring on the cheek-to-cheek, the heavy petting, then the home runs, but not ever with any of the following prohibited ridiculous lines. He says, I've never met anyone quite like you. Please. You remind me of my mom. Run, lady. Sex isn't really that important. Run very fast. Look, I just want to talk to you. Nothing will happen if I come in. Lock the door. I haven't felt this way about a woman in years. If said on the first date, call the cops. Just one more drink won't hurt. Take his keys and drive home without him. Want to see my tattoo? Begin coughing and don't stop. Tell him you picked up something in the Amazon rainforest. But it's not just the guys who come out with the ridiculous lines. Your reporter has tirelessly collected a few gems from the other side. She says, let's be friends. Fine. Date her best friend. My sister's got two beautiful kids. Whatever you do, do not have sex with this woman. I'm not that kind of girl. Get the telephone number of her best friend right now. Where do you buy your clothes? Get to a mirror fast. I'm so tired of the dating scene. Fella, she has designs on you. My ex-boyfriend, she's still in love. When I graduated from Vassar, run. My mother says, run faster. Once I make up my mind about a guy, lock the door. I feel we have a soul connection. Dial 911 right now. Christmas with my folks would be nice. That's it. Your dating days are done. With this little manual, you can survive the dating factor. But there isn't a manual in the world to help you survive the spouse factor. That's coming up next. Note to Gloria Steinem, Helen Gurley Brown, and the rest of them, sorry, it's not possible, girls. Nobody can have it all, especially when you're married to someone else and trying to make a sane life together. Marriage in America is perilous. You know the stats. Since I am beyond dumb in this area and haven't a clue why some marriages succeed and others fail, what can I tell you about the subject? Marriage is a very intense microscope that illuminates the character faults and good qualities that a man and woman bring to their relationship. Sometimes there are serious, even dangerous, disagreements that cannot ever be mended. Sometimes it's just the old question of how to pronounce tomato. Marriage is also vitally important to having a successful life. Even if I'm a dunderhead on the subject, my observations come from experience. I'm sharing them because, well, I'm a sharing kind of guy. Besides, even I might know as much as the experts who are all over the lot. Ridiculous note. Relationship expert Barbara DeAngelis has made a ton of money giving advice about love in her 8 best-selling books and a TV infomercial, Making Love Work. A busy gal, but busier than you might think. She is now working on her 5th marriage. I guess the American public isn't demanding rock-solid qualifications in this area, so I'll press on. Staying married is a bear. Right now, about 56% of American adults are legally married for the first, second, or nth time. About 1 in 10 American adults is divorced and hasn't remarried. For some reason, I was inspired to ask my father about marriage a few days after he and my mother celebrated their 35th wedding anniversary. So, Dad, what's marriage really like? You have no idea. Pause. I know. That's why I'm asking. You'll see. Pause. These answers did not, as you see, carry the conversation forward, but I was persistent. But I'd like to prepare a little. Can't prepare. Why not? He looked at me without any expression. You have no idea. Word for word, that was what my father had to say about marriage, but don't get the idea he was trapped or henpecked or bitter about his marriage. My father loved my mother, and vice versa. There was absolutely no reason for them to stay together otherwise. Strong as my parents' marriage was, it wasn't tested the way marriages are today. Since the 1960s, a couple walking down the aisle or taking their turn at City Hall are going to have huge expectations. You know what they are. A big house, late model cars, expensive with it clothes, great sex between hard bodies, varied and healthful food, separate space and mutual interests, stimulating conversation that helps each partner grow, fun parties and swell vacations, exceptional children who can be bragged about on social occasions and at the office, constant hugging and supportive endearments, old-fashioned considerate behavior, trendy progressive thinking, and don't forget the intelligent, cheerful, gifted pets. If that's your agenda, there is a quick route to reality. Run that list by your parents. Where do we get these expectations? Once again, the media factor is partly to blame. The worst culprits, hands down, are the magazines designed to appeal to women. Yes, you can have it all, the headline screams, while inside the article might inform female readers that their husband should be performing deft sexual acts at least 3 times a week and then spend the rest of their time at home remodeling the place into house beautiful. Mr. Wright should also be working long hours on the job so that the kids can dress in Calvin Klein and summer in Nova Scotia, just like the Kennedys or whoever happens to be profiled as the media's ideal family of the month. No wonder so many American husbands have this frozen grin on their faces all the time. A friend of mine is a perfect example. He has a pretty wife and 3 kids, and he is a prisoner in his own home. That's how he himself describes it. Recently, some of us guys planned a 3-day-long adventure in the wild, the kind of break guys have been taking to get sane long before anyone had ever heard of Robert Bly and his drums around the campfire. But we had to count our friend out. If I go on that trip, he told me, I won't get sex for 2 months. I don't think I can last 2 months. Why would my friend want to be in such a marriage? I don't get it. Whenever I see one partner giving up all power and decision-making to a spouse, I'm flabbergasted. To me, this is truly tragic. Is it a way of avoiding responsibility? Is it an emotional return to childhood? I have no bleeping idea. Dr. Laura probably knows, but I'm afraid to call her. I don't want to get yelled at. I do know this. The best thing about marriage is the opportunity to make another person's life richer on a daily basis. And I also know that it's not easy. That's why you have to marry someone who compliments you, not dominates you. Someone who compliments you, not depends too heavily on you. The best partners are the ones who can live life on their own. Does that sound like a contradiction? It isn't. The second best thing about marriage is the chance to raise children who will do positive things in this world. But if you let them see you acting like a doormat or a martyr, you're giving them the wrong message about adult life and companionship. Dicey as marriage is, it's worth it when two people respect each other's needs and learn to work together. Yes, I said work on the day-to-day responsibilities. No, you can't have it all because there's too much you have to get done. You can't have it all because no one's that lucky. You're lucky if you and your spouse really understand each other half the time. That's a windfall, I think. Two different people, no matter how much they love each other, are, well, there's always going to be differences. That's part of the fun, when it isn't part of the problem. And the children will challenge and change your relationship with your spouse in hundreds of ways. Yes, the children. Hey, stop making noise and go to sleep. You do not want me to come up there. Do you ever hear yourself saying these things without even thinking about it? Blame it on your parents. Because that's what your kids will do. They'll blame everything on you. We'll explain in the next discussion. But first, one final word on marriage. Don't do it if you are just trying things out. Live with the person, date him or her all the time, but don't get married unless you can put your spouse's needs above your own, constantly. Note to the late Duke of Windsor, you got some things dead wrong, Duke, and made a mess of your life and legacy for one very silly woman, I think. But I have to agree with what you said about your former colonies. The thing that impresses me most about America is the way parents obey their children. You got that right, Your Highness. In Bye Bye Birdie, Paul Lynn, playing a suburban American parent, unforgettably performed the song Kids with its catchy refrain. Kids, what's the matter with kids today? Why can't they be like I am, perfect in every way? Why indeed? Well, we'll have to set aside some of the childhood stories I've already told about myself. This is the golden age of the child in America, no question about it, especially in the middle class. Our kids are production numbers. We seem to believe, and they certainly agree, that they must have everything we did not have. The perks of today's childhood include play dates, private lessons, organized sports, tutors, electronic gadgets, frequent vacations, camps, theme parks, trendy clothes for play in school. If you've got a kid in a checkbook, you know what I mean. And you're expected to participate. You are on call to see it all. If you're a no-show, your child's self-esteem will be in jeopardy. And that's what many believe. In fact, you'll be scorned by other parents because they do realize the true value of self-esteem. Ridiculous note. Patty Pollard Ash of Greensboro, North Carolina, really wanted her son to do well in soccer. Watching him play a game one day, she took offense at the referee's unfair calls. She also took action. Running out on the field, she punched the official in the mouth. Did I mention the ref was 15 years old? We're talking high school here, Patty. Socking that kid didn't play well with the judge, who convicted this overeager soccer mom of assault. She was fined and banned from all soccer games for 3 years, a catastrophic punishment for a mother of this sort. So what's really going on here? As you would expect by now, I have a theory. In the 1960s, when the establishment couldn't handle the Vietnam War protests, and then the sex, drugs, and rock culture that swept the nation, we baby boomers got a tremendous taste of power and had, so it seemed to many of us at the time, unlimited possibilities. Whether you were liberal or conservative, you felt that you were going to change the world. Boomers expected to call their own shots in society forever. Life would be one long journey of accomplishment and self-gratification. But it didn't happen that way. A lot of us got burned. Who could have predicted it? Not the boomers, and certainly not their long-suffering parents. The ego-boosting of rebellion was replaced by the conformity of the workaday world. The dreams that materialized in a marijuana haze went up in smoke. Sorry. When the air cleared, you were sitting behind the same kind of desk your father sat behind. You were getting his same gut, and God help you, his same personality. For some disappointed baby boomers, I think, children conveniently stepped in to fill the void. Couples usually waited later than their own parents to have children, so they were more firmly established financially. Their children would become little trophies of the well-lived life. The kids' accomplishments would boost parental ego, and therein lies the problem. When children are being used to define a positive self-image for a boomer parent, their whims and feelings will be taken very seriously. The kids begin to rule. This is not good. Ridiculous note. A recent study showed that 20% of students in the Boston public schools flat out refused to do any homework. The superintendent quickly issued a statement that showed remarkable perspicacity. He suggested that the kid's parents were at least partly to blame. What is that man thinking? Is he ignoring the student's need for self-esteem at home? As you've seen by now, I cannot even imagine telling my father that his impatience with me and my behavior might cause my self-esteem to suffer. "I have your self-esteem right here," he'd probably say, and his only son would bolt up the stairs. Did my sister and I refuse to do our homework? Sure, and we used to have filet mignon every night for supper, too. Now, my father didn't get it totally right either, but somewhere between his bullheaded autocracy and the permissive idiocy of many boomer parents, there's got to be a middle ground. Otherwise, it's not going to be possible to raise children who turn out to be happy, productive adults rather than sad misfits who turn over a large piece of their take-home pay to a shrink with an eye tick. Finding the middle ground is not easy, but parents should try. To repeat, you will deeply regret it if you don't put in the effort that child raising requires. If you screw up big time, there is a huge chance the kid will mess up his or her life, and the boomerang effect can settle a heavy layer of dust over your golden years. Of course, it's always easier to explain what not to do. Here's an example. Because of my long legs, I always take an aisle seat in today's crowded airplane cabins. On a recent flight to Los Angeles, a kid behind me, who looked to be about 6 years old, kicked the back of my seat repeatedly. I was not soothed by this recreational activity. His mother, sitting next to him, could clearly see what he was doing. Turning around slowly, I silently gave her my best Clint Eastwood squint-eyed look. This caused her some alarm. "Ethan," she mumbled, "don't kick the man's chair. That's not nice." About 30 seconds later, another kick. I swear he put more sauce into it this time. "Ethan, didn't Mommy ask you not to do that? You are disturbing the man, Ethan. Please stop it." The kicking continued. "Mommy is going to punish you, Ethan, if you don't stop doing that. There'll be no ice cream when we land and no TV." She was beginning to sound desperate, and I knew this was going nowhere. Swift as a cheetah, I bounded to my full height and loomed large over Ethan. I stared down at him. I'm certain I made an impression, but he refused to look up. I shifted my glare to his mother and said, "When I come back from the bathroom, the kicking will cease." A few minutes later, I returned. Ethan was in the middle seat, his mother on the aisle behind me. She had to switch seats because she couldn't control him. This was pathetic. It also proved what I had already suspected. Ethan was acting like a brat because he did not fear his mother. As her conversation showed, she was a talker. She said entirely too much to her precious son. Sure, reasoning with certain children can work, but Ethan was long past that particular form of rehabilitation. When your kid is doing something that is obviously wrong, you should only have to say three words: knock it off. If the child doesn't stop immediately, you've got a problem. But your child should suddenly have an even bigger problem. Is spanking the answer in such a situation? Many Americans think so, but there is a big debate in our country about corporal punishment. I land somewhere in the middle myself. I wouldn't completely rule out spanking, but only as a last resort. I do believe in immediate attention-getting, uncomfortable punishment. I do believe in getting right up in your kid's face and explaining in no uncertain terms exactly what's going to happen next. The answer to little Ethan's defiance: make his life very unpleasant for a while. You will never teach your kid anything more important than discipline. It's the key to making everything work in your home, at the office, and in social situations. The high school where I taught those 2 years in Florida had the reputation of having very tough students, but I never had to use force. Instead, I devised punishments that specifically suited the lawbreakers and their offenses, and I administered those punishments swiftly. I didn't consider any kid's sense of self-esteem. If he or she got out of line, the hammer came down. They knew they could count on it every time. You've got to be just as consistent with your kids. You owe it to them. Sure, many a child can be a major pain in the posterior. I believe that they are put on this earth to test us. So pass the test. Have enough guts to teach your children the guidelines you'll enforce. That's a way of giving them stability. Think out punishment strategies, then have enough fortitude to follow through. That's the stick, but there's also the carrot. When your child does obey and does do the right thing, a reward should follow just as swiftly as punishment would, even if it's only a kind word or praise. You should think out your reward strategies as carefully as you've considered punishment strategies. This just in. Everything must be made as simple as possible, but not one bit simpler. Albert Einstein. Have I been oversimplifying the child-raising experience? Yeah, I mean, I'm a simple kind of guy. Simple is good. When your kid knows that bad behavior is always followed swiftly by predictable punishment, you'll be winning the battle. Repeat after me, simple is good. To reiterate, you are not a good parent unless and until you become the strong authority in your house. That does not include physical abuse or psychological brutality. You just need to establish yourself clearly as the person who can make your child's life unpleasant or pleasant in direct response to the type of behavior that goes on. And don't make the mistake of trying bribery. Once you start down that slippery slope, you begin accelerating toward warp speed. There won't be enough cookies, cakes, and video games in the world to keep up with the increasing demands. No, you have to be downright mean, the wicked stepmother, when kids do the wrong things, but sweet as Harriet Nelson when they behave correctly. Even the dimmest kid will catch on to that cause and effect program. But childhood turns out to be the easy part. When your kids reach their teen years, then it becomes children of the damned time for almost every parent in America. Dealing with teenagers might be easier if you were a Rockefeller. At the family mansion north of New York City in Westchester County, just recently opened to the public, you will see a huge estate house on the right as the tour bus takes you up the drive. The passengers always exclaim at its great size, and the tour guide explains, "That's the children's house. The mansion is farther on." Giving teenagers their own house is a very good idea, but not very practical for most of us. We have to live with our teenage children. We will earn an advantage if we've established discipline, a moral philosophy, and a consistent tone early on. If we wait until the hormones are in play, it will probably be too late. Disciplined, responsive teenagers do not spring out of the air. They are developed from disciplined tots. Even then, they will be loony and they will probably emit strange odors. But you'll get through it if you've been working on them in their earlier years. Backup stats. There are approximately 60 million children under the age of 14 in America today. About 18 million of them, or 30%, live in single-parent homes. And some 97% of those live with a mother, grandmother, or other female relative. There's more. 72% of all teenage murderers grow up in homes without a father. Many single moms are doing the best they can. Many of them work hard to support themselves and their children. But the kids are often left alone too much of the time or in the hands of others. They are at a tremendous disadvantage because a parent's time and discipline are in such short supply. This is a dangerous situation, but society can do little about it. Of course, the swirl of everyday life often leaves little time for important life lessons, even in homes where both parents are managing the household together. They have to set aside that time or it won't happen. In the teenage years, you will face new challenges. Two are more important than the others. You have to teach your teenagers to become aware of others and also how to think. Let's take awareness first. By nature, kids are egocentric, kind of like Hollywood celebrities. But they have no chance of succeeding in America today if they do not develop an awareness of the world outside themselves, especially when so many different cultures are coming to this country and joining the famous melting pot. Reading is one effective tool for developing awareness. Children should learn about reading long before they themselves can read by adults reading to them. They should know as toddlers that there is something magical about printed words. From the time they learn to read on their own, you should make sure that books are available to them. And you don't have to spend a lot of money. You can get fine secondhand books from garage sales and church benefits. And does the word library ring a bell? If your children don't take to reading right away, take your time and use your head. It doesn't matter what they read. It could be a kid's magazine about some hobby or sport they like. It could be the Sunday Funnies or Mad Magazine. Of course, they are more likely to believe that reading is fun if you are reading books and magazines yourself. You might also have to give your child a small reward for reading books at first. Gold stars worked in my elementary school. You might even have to make your child read. But someday the light bulb will go on and reading will become what it should be, a lifelong habit that enriches experience and brings home the wider world outside. After teaching awareness, you have to teach the use of brain power. Your teenagers can never succeed in this world, and they will miss most of what's going on in a changing society if they can't formulate logical and cogent thoughts. You should start teaching them how to think when they're small, maybe as young as age 7. Of course, the sad thing is that many adults themselves don't know how to think. You may have to give yourself a short course in rational thought processes. Don't be ashamed. You are only being a true blue American. For in this country, thinking is not widely encouraged. Logical thought is far too difficult and sometimes too painful for most of us. Instead, the national psyche prefers to react emotionally to events. If we feel it, it must be true. Besides, the establishment, including the media, does not want us to think for ourselves. Better that we laugh, cheer, weep, or just feel good. The establishment knows very well that people who begin thinking for themselves will begin seeing things for what they really are. Powers that be much prefer Americans who are easily led, easily distracted, and easily satisfied with lies and spin. In the interests of full disclosure, let me explain that my folks never taught me how to think. They were too busy reacting emotionally to all the stuff happening in their lives. So when I was a kid, I naturally imitated them. I didn't analyze situations. I just reacted. The result? Any conflict or threatening situation or misunderstanding just got worse. All heat, no light. Everybody in my neighborhood acted the same way. We yelled and screamed and stomped around without stepping back to think things through and figure out a different approach to a problem. In fact, I was well into my 30s before I developed the ability to step back and analyze situations that were or seemed to be threatening to me. Because I had been living an emotion-driven life for so long, I'd made many mistakes that could have easily been avoided if I had taken the time for the slightest amount of reflection. With luck and my own input, my kids will not make those kinds of mistakes. Besides, using your head ought to be fun as well as sensible. Why not try some thought drills with your teenager? At the supper table, ask your child what impressed him most that day in school and why. You'll probably get vague, bored responses at first. Make clear that's unacceptable. Get him to focus on one important thing that stood out during the day. First, it has to be described. Something learned in class or in a situation that happened in gym class or something with a friend or a teacher. Then it has to be explained. Why did this particular idea or event stand out? What did it mean? Did it change his view about something or make him want to learn more? When the day's choice is finally explained, you should discuss it. Show that you are interested in his opinion and explain what you like about his choices. You may be surprised, in fact, at what you learn about your teenager's daily experiences and how he is looking at life. His interests will surface and so will his fears. You'll have a terrific new way of keeping close tabs on the kind of information your teenager is digesting. After a few days, this will be fun for both of you if you do it the right way. Remember, simple is good. Also remember not to criticize your child's choice, even if it sounds dull or dopey to you. It's his life. He's living it. If he can explain his reasons, that's the point of the game. And since most kids love excitement, how about renting action movies with historical themes? There are hundreds of movies like Disney's Revolutionary War flick, Johnny Tremaine, and the Civil War epic, Glory. A good general rule about Hollywood is that the costumes and sets are likely to be historically accurate, even when the stories and characters stretch the limits of artistic license. Anyway, you aren't preparing your child for a history exam. You are making him or her aware of the world's amazing variety of experiences. You may have more and much better ideas for engaging your child's mind. The point is, it's your responsibility to teach your children to become aware of the world and to think logically. You can't depend on the schools to teach these things, except for the occasional outstanding teacher. As institutions of the establishment, schools are designed to teach conformity and the basics. Teachers know that, of course. For the big picture, you, the parent, have to make the extra effort. This is a gazillion times more important than yet another soccer game, but it should be made fun. One other thing, if you can get your kid interested in chess, that game will improve his mind and concentration. Finally, let's recall the strategy I suggested in regard to dealing with drugs and alcohol. Our family doesn't do that kind of stuff. We are better than that. Keep reinforcing that idea during the teenage years. From school, the neighborhood, and the tube, you will find numerous new examples of people who mess up their lives because of personal weakness. Make these sad stories into examples for your teenagers to avoid. Yes, it is lecturing, but your kids will listen to an interesting lecture on this subject. And if you are able to turn your lecturing into brainwashing, so much the better. That's good strategy. It will stay with the kid forever. Still, there are no guarantees. The son of one of the finest guys I know is a heroin addict. This selfish young jerk abandoned his own daughter, so his father is helping to raise her. The dad, who feels terrible about the whole situation, sometimes blames himself for his son's weakness and cruelty. No one else does. We all know that it is entirely the son's fault. He was unreachable. Some people are born self-destructive. There's nothing anyone can do about that. Some children will fail no matter what, just as some will succeed when the circumstances of home life are against them. No one knows the answers to these mysteries. That's just life. As I've said, my parents were basically clueless in the child-raising arena, but they did set a good example for me by being consistent. My sister and I knew what to expect and what was expected. I have no complaints. We went to church, we went to the beach, we were given birthday parties, we had clean clothes, and all of the basics. Since my folks didn't have money, the materialism addiction was never a threat. I never felt envious of what other kids had. I can remember thinking about material things only at Christmas, which seemed to be the point of that particular holiday, at least to us kids. And then there were the times when some of the other guys at my Catholic high school made fun of me for having only two sports jackets, neither of them exactly Armani. Most of the time, though, I knew I was pretty lucky. I saw some other kids who had drunken, sleazy, or uninterested parents. That was a much rougher go of it than being a two-jacket teenager whose parents didn't understand how to teach life skills. But the 21st century is going to be a greater challenge for teenagers than the 60s and 70s. Employment and social life will be much more competitive. Your kids will be judged every time they walk into a room or open their mouths, and some of those judgments may follow them for the rest of their lives. So here's a brief O'Reilly manual, not complete by any means, to suggest some of the things a parent today has to think about. Table manners. Miss Manners is right. No one wants to eat near a slob, whether she's the top pom-pom girl or he's the big man on campus. Rudeness spoils the finest meal. Also, it's unfair to let your children go into situations where they feel embarrassed because they don't know the basic rules of etiquette. Sit them down and explain how to use the silverware. Work on eating habits and table manners. These things matter. I've been at dinners where someone behaved with great courtesy, then made the mistake of folding her napkin at the end of the meal. It was the giveaway that she had not been raised properly, according to my upscale dinner companions. Suddenly, she dropped lower in their eyes. She didn't know that in this social set, you are supposed to crumple your napkin. Why does it matter? Is one method better than the other? Not really, but one is more acceptable, and people will notice. Grooming. This isn't easy, especially when dressing down is the style of the day. Still, good grooming is essential for success in America. Certain hip casualness in clothing shouldn't prevent anyone from keeping clean and healthy. Children should have straight teeth, even if they're wearing army boots and grunge. They should be taken to a dentist every 6 months, no exceptions, and to a dermatologist if there's a skin problem. They should be instructed in the use of deodorants, shaving products, and cleansing agents. When they manage to look clean and healthy, tell them so. Also, even though you may be rowing upstream against some mysterious fad, try to teach them the basics of sensible dress. In my teens, I often walked out of the house looking like a carnival display. No one told me that stripes and checks clash. Sanitation guys would mock my ridiculous color combinations. Ability to speak. Use one double negative in a white-collar job interview, and you are toast. You might get away with misusing pronouns, since a lot of public figures do it all the time, but you really should teach your children not to say between you and I or for he and she. Why? Call up your kid's English teacher or look through a grammar book. It's right there. As a parent, you should speak well yourself, and then insist upon proper English from the kids. And cursing is out. I cringe when parents swear in front of their children. This is nuts. They do not throw the F-word around at Harvard, in case you had to ask. Impose rigorous standards against swearing on your teenagers and on yourself. If the children complain, that's bleeping tough. A well-spoken individual is so rare in America these days that he quickly sets himself apart from the pack. And please don't make a fool of yourself by copying your teenager's use of slang. Let them say cool, awesome, and whatever to each other, because that's the point. Don't make these words the basis of family conversation between the generations. Courtesy. When did we forget that children need to be taught to be polite? Expressing themselves healthily does not include running into people in the mall or slamming doors or ripping things out of the hands of other children. These behaviors are just wrong. But if you want to be selfish about it, they are also dangerous to your kid's development. She will lose friends, expect too much of the world, and not understand why she is left out and behind. Courtesy is correct, but it also pays off. If your kid is impolite, send her off immediately to courtesy camp. What? There is no such thing? Well, I guess that means you will have to teach her how to behave in public places. That includes such things as opening doors for the elderly, giving the right of way to people coming out of doors, saying excuse me if she bumps into someone, and on and on. It's also true that courtesy is a cultural thing. In England, for example, if you accidentally step on someone's foot in a crowd, your victim will automatically say, excuse me, and mean it. In the United States, young children are usually expected to give their bus or subway seat to an elderly woman. In Italy, it's just the reverse. In many parts of the southern U.S., men of all ages say ma'am to women of all ages. Try that in Manhattan, and a woman might think you're implying that she's over the hill. In other words, courtesy is the custom of the country or the town or the neighborhood. You should learn the rules that apply where you live and pass them on. They say that courtesy is contagious, but if your kid seems immune, make sure she catches something she might not like. Spirituality. You may not be religious, but it's imperative to teach your child to respect nature. If you are religious, take responsibility for your child's spiritual life. Don't delegate this important teaching to anyone else entirely, even a rabbi, preacher, or priest. You have to provide your child with a moral foundation. Instilling an appreciation for the spiritual side of life will defend your children against the American emphasis on materialism. Devotion to accumulating things, rather than to helping others, is a mental cage that millions of us have enthusiastically walked into. Ultimately, though, that cage is not a nice place to be. And speaking of not nice places, do not try to teach morality by threatening your children with the fires of hell. Virtue should be its own reward, as the old saying goes. Kindness. Do you make the mistake so many parents make these days, worrying all the time about what your children are doing but not about what they're thinking? The inside of their heads is very important. That's who they are. It's the thinking that controls the doing, right? For example, kindness is so important to living a decent and productive life, you should talk about it often. Perhaps some children are born with a giving personality, but most need to be taught. Why not set up a game that awards points for being kind? Once a week, perhaps on Sunday, ask your kids what act of kindness they performed during the previous 7 days, and be prepared to answer the question yourself. Discuss what they report, then enter their story into a journal. At the end of the month, give them a kindness treat, a gift. A bribe? Well, sure, but it's a good bribe. After all, kindness easily becomes habit-forming, not because of your gifts, but because of the grateful reactions of the recipients of your kids' kindness. But be prepared for the times when the little old lady or whomever is suspicious of your kids' motives. That's another life lesson right there, unfortunately. You have to teach kindness because it's probably not on the curriculum in school, and it's certainly not being taught on Dawson's Creek. And if you're not at all that generous yourself, shame on you. But teach your teens altruism because you want them to have everything you don't have. Ridiculous note. Despite the furor of the Lewinsky scandal and other sordid associations, President Clinton was chosen the most admired man by Americans questioned in a 1998 Gallup poll. The Pope came in second. Ridiculous? Well, yeah. But in my opinion, this says more about our celebrity-mad culture than about anything else. With the White House backdrop and the helicopter and Air Force One, Mr. Clinton has a lock on the dazzle. The pontiff's spirituality is nowhere near being such good TV. That brings us to the next subject, the celebrity factor. Note to Sharon Stone, listening to you helps me understand why Americans turn to celebrities for advice. You are all so deep. When Special Prosecutor Kenneth Starr's investigation produced enough evidence to convince the House of Representatives to impeach Bill Clinton for perjury and obstruction of justice, you opined, "Those Republicans will, I swear to God, drag our nation into the gutter to take President Clinton with them. I just hate it." It's like the movie Fatal Attraction. Ken Starr is Glenn Close. That's some original political analysis, Sharon, but I don't quite get it. I'm pretty sure Starr didn't plunge a bunny into boiling water. I think he read the U.S. Constitution, though. Fame contributes so little of value, if anything, to our society. But Americans are absolutely out of their minds these days over celebrities. Millions of us spend a good part of our lives watching and reading about actors, politicians, sports figures, singers, and the rest. Even serial killers make the cut. Some of these celebrities, as far as I can tell, are famous only for being celebrities. I don't understand it. We really don't know anything about these people as human beings, but we get emotionally involved with them. We bring them into our homes via all of the media. We buy products they recommend, and we listen to what they say about the environment or the NRA. But we really do care less about their thoughts than about their private lives. Does Cher have a new boyfriend, and how much younger is he? What's going on with Tom Cruise's marriage to Nicole Kidman? Is Neve Campbell really happy? Whom did Derek Jeter pick up at the China Club last night? How can Kathy Lee Gifford stay with Frank after what he did in that hotel room? I don't know, you don't know, and she probably doesn't know, but I don't care. So what the bleep is going on here? In my 25 years of reporting, I've met hundreds of famous people. I think I've given them all a fair shot, but very few were impressive. For one thing, their fame burdens them with a sense of entitlement. They expect people to do things for them. They expect to be deferred to. Celebrity sighting. When I was a local news reporter for CBS's Channel 2 in New York City, I happened to be standing in line one day in the station cafeteria when in strolled Morley Safer, one of the stars of the top-rated national show 60 Minutes. Morley must have been in a hurry because he cut into the line ahead of me and others. Nobody said anything except for one solitary individual, me. You knew that, of course. I looked Morley in the eye and let forth with, "Hey, there's a line here, sir." Safer duly stepped aside and went back to the end of the line, but he was not happy. Oh yeah, this was another great political move for O'Reilly at CBS. A later celebrity sighting. Roger Ailes, my boss at Fox, got married recently, and the endless receiving line was chock full of famous faces, most of them behaving like normal people. Suddenly, Maury Povich and Connie Chung jumped in front of the entire line. Everybody saw it. Instantly, I came up with something very loud and very rude to say, but then I didn't say it. My rationalization was that I didn't want to embarrass Roger Ailes, but maybe I had more guts when I was younger. Yes, the famous are often under pressures that cause them to behave differently, but that sense of entitlement is a killer. It destroys humor and perspective, and sometimes it can be the death of relationships. Here are some short takes I've seen that tell much of the story. Baseball star Reggie Jackson walking past some kids in the lobby of a Boston hotel, snarling and refusing to sign their autograph books. Marlo Thomas throwing a fit, there's no other expression for it, when I asked whether or not her father's fame had helped her career. Tom Selleck's publicist telling me that the star demanded approval of any other guests that appeared after him on my news program. This was after the segment was taped and after Selleck himself had left the set. Sylvester Stallone refusing to allow any spectators watch him being interviewed by me. The room was cleared. All right, a celebrity can have a bad day just like the rest of us, but I think you see my point. When you're surrounded all the time by yes-men and hangers-on, when you're basking in waves of adulation, or so you think, you can lose all perspective. And Americans are not helping celebrities by worshiping them. Bad for them, bad for us, and a total waste of time. My personal all-time favorite celeb story features blonde bombshell Marla Maples and Donald Trump when their famous tabloid romance was at white heat. Marla was friends with a former girlfriend of mine, and these two ladies got the bright idea of going on a double date with the Donald and me. For a lot of reasons, this sounded like a bad idea to me. First and foremost, unlike most broadcast personalities you see on your home screen, I don't like to hang around socially with people I'm likely to report on someday. In that department, Maples and Trump were extremely likely suspects. But I was weak and gave in to the ladies. For reasons unknown to me, the date chosen was a Paula Abdul concert in the Meadowlands Complex in New Jersey. After all, the average age of the audience members at an Abdul concert is about 12. Anyway, we drove over in Trump's limo and we were waved into a parking lot beneath the Brendan Byrne Arena. We popped out of the car and took an elevator up to a private box to watch the show. To my surprise, things were going okay. Trump and I chatted casually about the football season and about his casinos. Our dates talked about their mutual friends and other pleasant subjects. The private box was luxurious. Everyone seemed to be having a good time. I wondered why I had resisted coming along. On stage, the first act was Color Me Bad, a group who opened with their hit song, I Wanna Sex You Up. It was downright bizarre when they asked the young kids to sing along. Thousands of preteens screaming, I wanna sex you up. You can imagine the faces of some of the parents who had come with their kids. They were aghast. It was an unforgettable moment in concert history. There was an intermission after the sex guys act. That's when things began to get interesting in our party. Trump suggested that we all take a walk around the arena. What? If you missed the Marla Donald story, you're probably still waiting to hear about the sinking of the Titanic, the defeat of the Nazis in a certain blue dress. This was the tabloid story that sold papers and boosted TV ratings for months, and there were thousands of people milling around down there in the arena. They'd all seen the photos, I knew it. So Donald Trump really wanted to walk around the arena? Yep, he did. I said to him that it was probably not a good idea to take a stroll without massive security, like, to begin with, a battalion of fully armed, battle-tested U.S. Marines with full metal jackets. Some rudeness might break out, I continued. And what about Sexpot Marla in those 6-inch spiked heels? No problem, Donald said. We have Tony and Lou with us. Okay, personal bodyguards Tony and Lou were certainly large and testy, but the odds against them were about 15,000 to 2, odds I did not like. But this excursion wasn't my problem, I decided. It was their choice. I'd wait for them to come back. But my decision made Marla unhappy. For some reason, she insisted that my date and I go out there with them, out there where the mob would instantly recognize the cosmically famous lovebirds. And then my date looked at me with great sadness in her eyes. Why was I doing this to her? The sad eyes got to me and I gave in. Taking a deep breath, I stepped out of the luxury box and our walk began. You can picture it, I know. Within 10 seconds, the hallway of the Brendan Byrne Arena was in chaos. The excited teenagers, already revved up by Color Me Bad, dropped popcorn boxes, spilled soda, spit beer. The whole thing was nuts. Some people said nice things, some people were very mean. Most of the guys, of course, focused on Marla, who was dressed or sewn into a tourniquet-tight black outfit. They stared in a way that is usually seen only in prison. And then there were those who simply screamed the name Donald over and over. He loved it. We only walked around, fought the tides, for about 10 minutes, but it seemed longer than Lewis and Clark's trek on the PBS series. Trump, whose bodyguards somehow kept everyone from actually touching him, couldn't get enough of the scene. Marla looked uneasy but tried to smile. Since I felt I was in the Rocky Horror Picture Show, I tried to blend into the crowd of extras, keeping as far as possible from the celebrity couple. But our stroll wasn't enough for Trump. He now wanted to watch the rest of the concert from the floor. So long, luxury box. Standing on the arena floor, surrounded by extra security guards, we watched Paula Abdul perform the rest of the concert. As she sang and danced, the crowd kept screaming, Donald and Marla. Paula seemed confused by that. We went backstage after the show to say hello to the star, who could not have been nicer to us, no matter what she thought of the demonstration on the floor. That was the end of the double date. I couldn't wait to get home. What I'd seen, if I haven't made it clear, was Trump's addiction to fame in full force. He didn't do anything that terrible, but his actions that night showed me that money and power just aren't enough once a certain kind of person has tasted fame. Trump feasted on that nutty adulation. He craved the roar of the crowd, and he got it. But why were the young teenagers going wild at the sight of this balding, paunchy builder? Well, it's not because he's an entertainer or an athlete or a poet or a statesman, and it's certainly not because of his business acumen. Those kids couldn't care less about that kind of thing at their age. No, Trump was a celebrity to this crowd simply because he was having an affair with a glamorous woman. That was all it took to propel him into the public consciousness and give him the fame that he wanted so much. Is this a crazy society? Yes, it is. There is some good news in the celebrity orbit, though. I don't want to close this discussion without giving the nod to some very admirable celebrities. Arthur Haley, most famous for Airport, but the author of many other best-selling books, had never met me when I finished my novel, Those Who Trespass. That didn't keep him from taking the time to read the book and send my publisher an enthusiastic blurb. He got nothing for doing this favor. In addition,